And welcome to a Juno Afternoon. My name is Jamie Waste. I'll be your host for today's program. Following National Native News, we'll get an update on Eagle Crest activities with Jeffrey Clow. Crystal Borland will give an update on workshops sponsored by the Juno National Alliance on Mental Illness, a preview of upcoming cooperative extension programs, including a Master Gardener class. And we'll talk with Ewan Bond, this evening's Alaska Design Forum speaker. Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and more up next on a Juno Afternoon on KTOO Juno, repeated at 4 on KRNN and available on demand at ktoo.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Canadian Human Rights Tribunal issued a landmark ruling on Tuesday. After an emotional 9-year fight, the tribunal says the Canadian government is discriminating against First Nations children on reserves. Dan Karpinchuk has more on the ruling and reaction from officials.
The complaint to the Human Rights Tribunal was first brought in 2007 by Native groups. They argued that the level of child welfare services available on reserves was far less than what was available elsewhere, even though the need was far greater. And that meant there was less money for family support, so more Native children ended up in the welfare system. Cindy Blackstock is the child welfare advocate who helped launch the complaint. She praises the tribunal's decision and its call for Ottawa to immediately address the long-standing issue of underfunding services that directly affect children on reserves.
Children only get one childhood. They shouldn't have to wait for studies. The government knows what to do for this generation of children. I pray that we can finally use this as a nation to end the racial discrimination that is happening in this country. This is our Mississippi.
Praise for the ruling also came from the Assembly of First Nations, the National Chief, Perry Bellegarde.
There's an opportunity now to fix the system and to make sure that those needs are addressed immediately.
It's estimated that up to $200 million a year more is needed to close the funding gap. Canada's Justice Minister, former British Columbia Chief Jody Wilson-Raybould, says the federal government will not challenge the ruling.
We can and must do better, and we will renovate the child welfare system in this country.
Wilson-Raybould agreed that the human rights ruling is about equity and the need to create space in Canada for every child to be able to succeed. Ottawa is also calling for a meeting with First Nations chiefs to address the issue as soon as possible. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Democratic leaders in the South Dakota legislature say they're optimistic about the governor's proposal to expand Medicaid. As South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Jennifer Jones reports, they say it could transform the Indian Health Service.
Assistant State Minority Leader Troy Heinert is a member of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe. He says Native Americans face a lack of access to quality care through the Indian Health Service.
How do we transform what is happening at IHS? Because if you are Medicaid eligible right now and you go to an IHS facility, that is 100% federal Medicaid dollar. There's no IHS dollar, there's no state dollar. As soon as you leave that IHS facility, that becomes half federal, half state dollar. That IHS dollar is already small. It's critically underfunded.
He says with the new FMAP rate and contracting authority that IHS would have, the Medicaid expansion plan allows hospitals access to things like e-emergency and telehealth services. Senate Majority Whip Deb Soholt says the conversation between the tribes, state government, and healthcare systems is a great step forward.
The thought that we could have that be an extension of what is their treaty obligation for Indian health services, that you don't have to just go back to the person that's on the reservation, I think it really speaks to assimilation within the whole state and really looking out for all of our citizens, not thinking of a separateness, if you will.
State leaders are still waiting for more information from the federal government before forming a concrete plan. That could take a few weeks. Republican leaders say there are some concerns about costs. For National Native News, I'm Jennifer Jones.
Navajo lawmakers approved legislation Tuesday to create a Veterans Council and administration. The Veterans Administration would provide services to Navajo veterans. The Advisory Council would allow participation from veterans in policy matters. Many Navajo veterans say they have limited access to federal and state health benefits, especially those who live in remote areas. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Kawanic Broadcast Corporation is accepting artwork and reservations for the Alaska Native Art Auction February 18, 2016 in Anchorage, Alaska. Over 400 business leaders and executives attend this annual event. Proceeds benefit Kawanic's news program. Learn more at knba.org.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
And I'm happy to introduce Jeff Reclau, who's a familiar face and a familiar voice on a Juneau afternoon, especially during the ski season, of course, from Eagle Crest, down from the slope.
Down from the slopes. Thanks for having me on the show this afternoon again.
Well, it's always great having you guys in the studio, and sometimes it's really exciting, the news, and then sometimes the news can be a little disheartening.
Can be a little damp.
A little damp.
So we did make the tough decision this afternoon to actually close the mountain tomorrow, Thursday. We've had some pretty wet, warm weather the last couple of days, and so the lower mountain took a beating. The upper mountain's still in great shape, and I skied on Monday all day, and it was fabulous skiing on Monday, just wet. But the lower mountain took a little bit of a beating the last couple of days, so we're going to close the mountain down on tomorrow, Thursday, and let the water drain out of the snow, which hopefully will dry out that snow and allow us to move some around a little bit and cover up the brown patches and the icy patches that have developed.
So first off, that's darn. It's always sad to hear the mountain close, and hopefully, of course, the weather will change and more snow will come and it'll reopen. But for the moment, when you say let the mountain drain, I'm just curious, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think it's no surprise to anyone that we've had some really wet weather, and so when that gets in there, the snow ends up to hold that water and become pretty dense, pretty wet snow. And so when we move it around, it then just tends to disappear. So by letting the water drain out of that, the snow dries out a little bit, and then you can actually move it around and save the snow rather than watching it melt away. So it's kind of standard in a lot of ski areas that experience some wet. We were hoping we wouldn't have to go there this year, but we looked at the conditions, wanting to continue on with the great season that we've had so far this season. So we made the tough decision to close tomorrow. Hopefully it'll just be one day of letting the mountain recover, if not a couple of days. But we're still looking forward to the weekend and some great skiing and riding for the season. It's not over yet.
So once the water has drained, whether that's a day or two, however long, then the crew has a job here. And what does the crew do?
So then the mountain ops crew, the grooming crew, gets out there with the snowcats, and they're able to push the snow around, and they're able to move it a lot easier, a lot more effectively and efficiently, and not lose the snow when they move it. So they'll cover up brown spots, move snow. We've been able to make snow in a few locations, and have that snow saved, so we're able to push that man-made snow around to places that we need it. And hopefully Mother Nature will cool off the conditions a little bit. The forecast looks like some cooling is coming our way, and we'll be able to get more snow down at the base, which is where we need it.
So at minimum, a one-day closure. If it extends into several days, are any activities in the pipeline that you folks are struggling with going, oh, gosh, what do we do with this now?
Oh, yes. And unfortunately, we had always planned this weekend to be our 40th anniversary celebration.
This is that retro day, right?
Retro.
$7 tickets,
yeah,
and all that.
Rollback weekend, Saturday and Sunday. We're going to have a beer garden with Louie's, and we were doing some really fun things on the mountain. So we decided that we were just going to take a look at what the conditions look like tomorrow when all staff, essential staff, goes back up on the mountain and takes a look at it. And we're going to make a decision on what we do with the weekend, whether we go ahead and are able to do the rollback 40th anniversary celebration this weekend, or whether we decide to postpone it. So we'll send out another press release tomorrow and do through social media and our website at skijuneau.com, and just kind of relax, just breathe a little bit and go see what Mother Nature has in store for us.
other than this, the headline here, anything else Eagle Crest related that you wanted to talk about today?
Well, I think, some people start to hear the word closed and they go, oh, that's it. The season is over. And
right.
I just
It's
way too early than that. And we have so much snow. I just got an email from a friend of mine down in Montana, and she said, oh, you guys have so much more snow at the top of the mountain than we do down in Montana. And it's so true. The conditions up on the upper mountain are fabulous. We are going to ski and ride as long as we can this season, which I have no doubt will be until April 10th. I think this is just a little bump in the road, and we'll be open by the weekend, and everyone will be enjoying some good skiing and riding.
And so, just curious, for Nordic, the upper loop, is that still in good shape?
The upper loop is still in good shape. It's up above that kind of line that we've been experiencing, and so at this point we're planning on having that open up this weekend, Friday. It won't be open tomorrow, but Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. Again, check out skijuno.com or call our snow conditions hotline at 586-5330. Or follow us on your favorite social media site. But we want to be skiing and snowboarding as much as everyone else does.
But not tomorrow.
Tomorrow is a day to clean the house or do that grocery shopping or go to recycling.
Yeah, very good. Jeffrey Cloud, thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me this afternoon.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 27th of January, 2016. It's the birthday of Mozart. It's the day on which Dante was exiled from Florence and he began to write the Divine Comedy. Also the birthday of the man who created the periodic table of elements, the Russian chemist Dmitri Mendeleev, born in Siberia in 1834. Mozart, born in Salzburg, 1756, was composing music at the age of 5. When he was just 7, his father took him and his sister Nannerl on a tour of Europe. It went on for 3 years. They played for kings and queens. And Mozart met Johann Christian Bach, the son of Johann Sebastian, who became his teacher briefly. Mozart was 13 when he and his father went to Italy. There he heard a performance of a choral piece by a composer named Gregorio Allegri, which had never been published, but after hearing it once, the 13-year-old Mozart was able to write out the entire 9-part choral piece from memory. He was a court musician in Salzburg for a time, but the archbishop was a difficult employer, and so Mozart left him and moved to Vienna, where he had to struggle to make a living, but he had more freedom as an artist, and where he died in poverty of unknown causes at the age of 35. Mozart, who wrote, "To win applause, one must write stuff so simple that a coachman might sing it, or so incomprehensible that it pleases simply because no sensible man can comprehend it." It was on this day, 1302, the Italian poet Dante Alighieri was exiled from Florence for his political beliefs and spent the next 2 decades wandering from place to place, estranged from his wife and children, living in poverty, and writing his great work, The Divine Comedy. And it's the birthday of the man who wrote Smoke Gets in Your Eyes and Old Man River and The Way You Look Tonight, the composer Jerome Kern, New York City, 1885, worked with many different lyricists, Oscar Hammerstein II, P.G. Wodehouse, best known for the musical Showboat. Here's a poem for today by Edward Denby, entitled Song. I don't know any more what it used to be before I saw you at table sitting across from me. All I can remember is I saw you look at me and I couldn't breathe, and I hurt so bad I couldn't see. I couldn't see, but just your looking eyes, and my ears was buzzing with a thumping noise, and I was scared the way everything went rushing around, like I was all alone, like I was going to drown. There wasn't nothing left except the light of your face. There might have been no people, there might have been no place, like as if a dream were to be stronger than thought and could walk into the sun and be stronger than aught. Then someone says something, and then you spoke, and I couldn't hardly answer up, but it sounded like a croak, so I just sat still, and nobody knew that since that happened, all of everything is you. A poem by Edward Denby, Song, from The Complete Poems, published by Random House, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. You can subscribe to the Poetry Magazine podcast and the Poetry Off the Shelf podcast in the iTunes Store or listen at poetryfoundation.org. And by Lumosity.com, brain training developed by scientists to challenge memory and problem solving through online games. Lumosity.com. Engineered by Noah Smith and produced by Joy Biles, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Juno Douglas High School's theater department is proud to present the boisterously fun romantic musical Seven Brides for Seven Brothers. Come enjoy this romp through the 1850s as you cheer on a new pioneer bride who needs to marry off her six rowdy brothers-in-law before it's too late. Playing at the JDHS Auditorium January 29th and 30th and February 4th, 5th, and 6th at 7 p.m. and a matinee on January 30th at 2 p.m. Tickets available at Hearthside and JAHC.org.
A Juno afternoon continues, and the next topic we have in the studio Crystal Borland from the Juno National Alliance on Mental Illness, also known as NAMI. Now, many people in the community, Crystal, I think usually refer to it as NAMI. I'm not sure why, but NAMI's the correct acronym pronunciation, right?
Yes. The executive director of NAMI National pronounces it NAMI, so I've just taken my lead from there. But if you say NAMI, I know exactly what you're talking about, and most do other people. So.
But we will all try to say NAMI from now on, just to get it right. So you're in because you've got some upcoming programs that you want to talk about. So why don't we start with the first one, which I think was or is the Family to Family program, correct?
Right. So we have a class called Family to Family. It's starting this coming Monday on February 1st. And this is for family members or friends who have a loved one with a mental illness who are looking to better understand all aspects of mental illness, to get some support and insight. And so the curriculum is 12 sessions. So we'll meet Monday and Wednesdays for 6 weeks through March 8th. And just encourage if people are interested, we have some spots available so they could give us a call.
You know, so mental illness is, there's such a stigma that is there, I think, for individuals who have a mental illness and for family members and friends. And just, I think there's such a societal stigma, or there has been. So, what is mental illness? I mean, describe that for people so people understand, because some of it's very commonplace,
sure,
things that we're surrounded by all the time with family or friends or...
Right. I think most of us are affected, first of all, and I think that's one of the stigmas out there is that people feel very isolated by it, like no one's going through it, and really the reality is it's quite common.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the stigma is changing over time. I think in my generation we'll see that really drops significantly, and especially as research really gives us a lot more answers, because a lot of it is we just don't understand it totally. But to kind of sum it up, mental illness is a medical condition, so like any other physical condition, and it disrupts a person's thinking and mood and feeling, and so it's kind of this invisible thing, but it can really impair functioning and just, it can take a big toll on a person's life. And like anything, there's kind of a range of symptoms, a range of mental illnesses, and I can talk about some common ones.
Yeah, and so NAMI, the Juno National Alliance on Mental Illness, you folks work in this space in people's lives. So what kind of services? I mean, you just mentioned this one particular program coming up, and we can go back to that. But just sure. Overall, why do you guys exist? What do you do for the community?
So we started as a group of families. So this is the largest grassroots mental health organization in the nation, and it started in 1979 when deinstitutionalization was at its height. So all these individuals that had been in state hospitals were coming back into the community. And unfortunately, those community supports were not beefed up enough to really help support people. So family members came together to learn from each other, to get information, and to start build up those community supports. And so what we do now at the local level is we really just help people, support them, and give them information, and not just the individual with mental illness, but the family members as well. And we do that through free classes and support groups, and the class such as Family to Family, which is coming up, again, gives people that education, and it gives them other peers to connect with and talk about similar challenges that they've gone through.
So for people in our audience who are aware of their mental illness or their friend's mental illness mm-hmm. or what have you, they may understand what you're talking about. But for others who are not quite sure what you're talking about, give some examples of mental illnesses or mental health issues that are common or maybe not so common, but so that are applicable here so that people might understand why a program like this may be of interest to them.
Sure. So just to talk about some of the language, mental illness kind of is this umbrella, and then there's different categories and different types of illnesses. And some of the more common ones are major depression, used to be known as clinical depression, really kind of feelings of hopelessness and despair. It can just debilitate a person in their day-to-day functioning and make coping with daily stressors really challenging. There's schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. So there's quite a few different diagnoses out there. But a lot of times these symptoms are not necessarily known necessarily to the individual, and it might take a long time for them to actually get diagnosis. And what we know with mental illness is there's a big lag time between symptoms presenting to where people are actually getting treatment, which is why organizations like NAMI are so important to really try to educate and build up that public awareness.
So there's the challenge for the individual who has the illness and is struggling, and then there's the challenge for the family and the friends, and that's what your upcoming program is all about. Do you want to speak a little bit to, you know, why something like this is important to offer to the supporting love system or whatever of that individual?
Yeah, well, it's just really treating it holistically. A lot of times things that impact our family members are also impacting us. And so it's, education is empowerment, and it's the same here. With treatment, a lot of times if an individual is receiving treatment, their family isn't very heavily involved in that plan, and they might not know what's going on. And so this gives them a way to really advocate for that person, to learn that they can be a part of that treatment process, and just to get, again, some of those tools. Some of the things that are talked about are how to deal with crisis if their family member ever gets into crisis or relapse, and also skills for communicating and problem solving. So more than just learning, it's also some skill building there.
Is this is it specifically for family, or is it just close friends, the support system?
The support system. We say family members. It could be friends, but generally we're seeing family members.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, I think for the individual who's suffering from the illness or struggling with the illness, it's such an isolating experience that I think the role and potentially quite isolating for the family members too. And but they play a huge role, or they potentially play a huge role in supporting that person, coexisting with it, living with it, overcoming it, surviving it.
Right. Got it. Okay. So, and just to add to that, we do have a class now that we started this year for individuals who do have a mental health diagnosis. And it's similar to family in that it's education, but it's built-in support because you're connecting to other people that have those similar challenges. It's called peer-to-peer, and we'll have another one this spring. So details are always on our website at namijuno.org.
So the Family mm-hmm. to Family program, why don't you just give the details on that again?
Sure.
It's coming up. What are the basic details about it?
So registration is online at NAMIJUNO.org. They can call the office at 463-4251. Again, 463-4251. And it's going to be Monday and Wednesday evenings starting at 5:15. We're at Bartlett in their administration building, the second floor boardroom. And the class goes through March 8th. So we really want people to commit to hopefully the majority of those classes because they build upon each other.
You also mentioned before we opened up the microphones and started chatting, something else to talk about maybe is the Inside Passage program. You have these monthly forums. Do you want to touch on those just
right.
a little bit?
This is our way to connect more to the community, to mental health professionals, and just interested community members that want to learn about mental health. And so these are monthly forums. They're also at Bartlett in the boardroom on the second Tuesday of every month, September through May. So next, this month, we get to hear from Steve Murley, and he's going to be talking about nervous system dysregulation and the nature of trauma. And that's going to be on February 9th. So sorry, not quite this month, but February 9th. And again, we have kind of updates on our website about each month's topics, which vary each month. And they're really informative, and it's fun to discuss with other people that are interested in these topics.
And are those topics kind of somewhat different than mental illness per se? Are your mental health, mental wellness? I mean, are
mental
they getting
mental health and wellness?
Yeah.
It's all kind of within the realm. So,
right.
And we really try to hear from a variety of speakers and different practices, but all in relation to mental health. Yes.
Anything else you wanted to bring up today on a Juno afternoon?
I think that's it. I just appreciate the opportunity to come and talk about it. And again, those family-to-family classes, get information on our website. We also have other classes for individuals living with mental illness, ongoing support groups, and the Inside Passages monthly forums on mental health and wellness.
Well, thank you. The services you and your staff and the organization are providing are invaluable in the community here and across the country. So, Crystal Borland, Executive Director of NAMI, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Jamie.
Join us February 4th for the next event in the KRNN Spotlight Series, a tribute to Carole King, featuring performances by Colette Costa, Delisa Thole, Shona Osterhout, and Jocelyn Miles, with accompaniment by Rob Cohen and Clay Good. We'll celebrate the 45th anniversary of Tapestry with a full album performance, and we'll also showcase several of her other hits. That's February 4th at 7 at the Goldtown Theater. Tickets at KRNN.org and the station. Oh.
and a Juno Afternoon continues with Darren Snyder, who is the Juno District Agent. The Juno District Agent, or one of several? I can't. What's your title?
Oh well, I am the Juno District Agent in the area of agriculture and horticulture and 4-H youth development. And we are blessed with another agent in our office here and serving all of Southeast, and that is Sarah Lewis.
And this is with the Cooperative Extension Program.
Right, exactly. So UAF Cooperative Extension Service, and yeah. We are at your service. So bringing the university to the people is our motto.
So you've got a couple of fun things to talk about, but first, maybe just a little for people who really don't know about the Cooperative Extension Service. Yeah. What do you do for the community and for people? And
yeah, so we are an institution that's been around for 100 plus years. We are always throughout the nation associated with your land grant university system. It's a way for the general public to get the benefit from the university and from the U.S. Department of Agriculture for us to engage with communities and be responsive to what communities are interested in learning about and doing. And that translates to through Sarah Lewis's programs, kind of a home ec focus, where there's food preservation, wild foods gathering, air quality and energy, residential energy type of programs. And then my programs are kind of a combination of how to produce food through gardening, and whether you want to be doing it commercially, if you want to be starting up a business, a small agricultural business or hydroponics or what have you, I can connect you to resources and provide a degree of training for that. And then as well, my other hat is the 4-H youth programs.
Yeah. Small staff cranking it out and an incredible amount of activity and community engagement and involvement all throughout the year. And so you have a Master Gardening program coming up. So why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, the Master Gardener program is you know, along with 4-H, is the reason why it seems like we can do so much through the Extension Service, because what the Master Gardener program is a volunteer training program. It's even though it says, you know, Master Gardening, it's not just about how to become a better gardener, but it's how to turn that into service for our community and to kind of expand the university's reach into the communities. So what it is a 40-hour course, and it's having experienced gardeners get in-depth knowledge on anything from soil to seed to flower to plant to produce, everything having to do with growing and designing, whether it be edible food type of produce or just beautification of your landscape. And so what we're trying to do is get people who are experienced gardeners to come in and get this additional training from myself, other experts in the community. We have folks lined up from kind of a who's who, not every who's who, because there are so many excellent horticulturists in our community. But we have folks lined up such as Dave Lendrum and Margaret Tharp with Landscape Alaska going to come in and teach a session or two. We've got Ed Byarski with Ed's Edibles. We got Suzanne and Sandy Williams, who are local experts in gardening techniques. We got Merrill Jensen of the Jensen Olson Arboretum coming in. Elfrida Nord.
This is the Hall of Fame of
totally
Master Gardeners.
Exactly.
So, but that's a question I have for you, though. My perception is that Juno is an avid gardening community, even though we live in a rainforest. And I've always, and every time I hear the phrase Master Gardener, I think, oh, I bet you there's a bunch of Master Gardeners around. And some of the names you just rattled off, I recognize them all as Master Gardeners. But I'm curious. Do you know? Do we have a lot of Master Gardeners? Above and beyond that, they're just not as titled, if you will, or as well known.
We do have a lot of gardening that goes on. Period. And we've got a lot. We have such a challenging environment here that some people who
you almost have to be a Master Gardener.
Yeah, you have to at least a dedicated one.
But in this case, it's an actual credentialed thing.
It is. Yeah, and so we have a number of people who have gone through the Master Gardener training, and many of those folks have taken it to the next step, which is to provide service in the community through many different forms. I'd love to share with you some of these different projects they've done in time, but that's really kind of after you've gone through the course and you've completed your what is a 40-hour commitment of service, then it, you know, you're bestowed as a master gardener. Mm-hmm. And now a lot of people will look at themselves in the mirror and they'll look at some of our, you know, Ed Byerskys in the community and say, oh, what? I'm not a master gardener. I've only been gardening for a few years. I took this course. But, you know, it's a matter of scale where people mm-hmm. will just, you know, if you're willing to engage with doing some great projects in the community, to learn more and to share it with others, then yes, you do have this official title, and whether you like the title or not, you got to call it something. So it's called the Master Gardener Program, the Alaska Master Gardener Program. Yeah.
So we'll switch gears here to the 4-H Club, but before we do, just give the details again about the course itself and getting involved with it.
Yeah. So it begins February 9th, so coming up here pretty soon, and it's going to be on Tuesday evenings from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. and then a couple Saturdays along the way as well. And we're going to be running, since it's 40 hours, it runs all the way through the end of April. And we'd love it if you'd be able to, you do need to be able to make most of those classes. If you're going to be traveling for a period of time during that, you can call me and talk to me about your schedule and see if it might work for us. It's going to be on Tuesday evenings starting on February 9th.
Very good. 4-H Club.
Yeah, so 4-H is a program that we run throughout Southeast, but since I'm here in Juneau, this is where most of our program is focused. We have a number of clubs going on right now, different club activities. We have a sailing club. We have a luge sledding club. We have our traditional horse club, lots of different things going on. And 4-H is a program that is for both girls and boys to work together and be together in a single club environment. It's not separated by genders. And it can be on any topic that if there's a caring adult that wants to share about a topic with youth, then please call me. If you'd like to, we are always needing adult volunteers to come and join us and to work with kids in the community.
And you have an outdoor skills and adventures or adventure program coming up for the kids. So
yeah,
tell us about that.
Yeah, this camp is the fifth year, I think, that we've had this residential camp. We team up with the Department of Fish and Game, who helps us administer this camp. You know, I got to name names. Kristen Romanoff has been an awesome partner with that. Abby Lowell is our new regional educator, and she's going to be also helping run the camp. So, again, I don't need to name all the names, but it's a who's who, and it's a great for middle schoolers, any youth who are entering middle school and through high school. So middle school through high school, if you have a fifth grader who's going into sixth grade, they qualify. They're of the right age to enter the camp. And it's going to be happening on the beginning of June, so June 6th. Through the 10th, so that's a Monday through Friday, and we hold it out at the Eagle River Scout Camp, and it's a ton of fun. It's if anything you can think of having to do with Alaskan skills, anything from how to fish, how to process fish, how to smoke and can fish, processing deer, kayaking, building shelters, survival activities, campfire cooking, all the kind of camp kind of skits and having fun with that. And it's a great fun. And if you want to see something on it, we did a nice little video on our Facebook page. If you go to our Juneau, Alaska 4-H Facebook page, you can find a video from our last year's camp, and it shows some of the fun that's been going on.
So that's coming up in June, but you're promoting it early because it probably fills up, is my guess.
And it does fill up, but also I know that planners out there, families need to be getting ready for summer, so this is your heads up.
Well, if you don't plan, there's no space available.
Exactly.
So again, if somebody is interested in that program, where do they get the details?
Best thing is just to call us, 523-3280, 523-3280. If you you can talk to Susie, who's at our office, and she is able to help you get signed up for any of these things, the Master Gardener course, the 4-H program, 4-H camp, all of these things.
Darren, anything else you wanted to slip into the conversation today before we switch gears?
Yeah, one quick thing is that for all of you Alaska Master Gardeners out there, or even wannabes out there, we have a general membership meeting for those of you who have gone through the Master Gardener program, and it's this weekend. So on January 30th at the Valley Library, so this Saturday, at the Valley Library from 2 to 4 p.m. And so this is a kind of a get-together for the Southeast Master Gardener Association. Please come. It's a great way to meet other Master Gardeners. Even if you haven't participated recently, we'd love to meet you and to invite you to join in the fun.
Darren Snyder with the Juneau Cooperative Extension Service. As always, thank you for coming in, and thank you and your staff and crew and all the volunteers for all the work you guys do in the community.
You're welcome, Jamie. Thanks a lot.
This is Bird Note. In winter, when snow blankets the northern states, nearly all of the beautiful songbirds that grace the days of summer are long gone. They're living out the cold months in warmer climes. But there's one special winter visitor that goes a long way to filling the absence left by the birds of summer. Picture a starling-sized bird with a swanky crest, a black mask, wings painted in red, yellow, black, and white, and a tail boldly tipped with yellow. This glamorous winter visitor is the Bohemian waxwing. When Bohemian waxwings appear on the scene, they arrive in flocks, often numbering in the hundreds. They roam the landscape in search of winter fruits, berries of mountain ash or juniper, rose hips, even unpicked apples. In autumn, departing their summer haunts in the boreal forest, waxwings wander south into the northern states and along the Rockies. Some years they venture even farther south. In fact, it's this itinerant life that earned them the name Bohemian, although the name seems equally well suited to their unconventional and exquisite appearance. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
And that music is the, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, the Leisender Piano Trio, and they will be performing here in Juneau Saturday, February 6th at the Jack, 7 o'clock. More great arts, entertainment, culture coming to the capital city, and that's our last installment here today on a Juneau afternoon. Fits right into that category. I think it's just this time of year. Evelyn, correct me if I'm wrong. It's not year-round that this series is
the
up.
Design Forum, we have lectures in the fall and the spring. Yeah, not in the summer.
Right. So that's Evelyn Russo with the...
In the winter.
With the Alaska Design Forum. And our guest today is Iwan Ban. Is that correct?
Yes.
welcome to Juneau.
Thanks for having me here.
Iwan is the presenting is the speaker tonight with the Design Forum. This is going to be tonight at 6 o'clock at the Gold Town Theater. And so welcome to Juneau.
Thanks for having me here, yes.
Have you been here before?
No, it's even my first time to Alaska. I travel a lot, but somehow never made it this far up north, the Americas, so it's very nice to be here.
And is this the third stop? Have you been in Anchorage and Fairbanks already?
Yes, the last days in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and this is the last stop here for the lectures, and then tomorrow I go back to Anchorage and hope to explore a little bit more here of Alaska.
Very good. And where is home for you?
I'm originally from the Netherlands, and it's still officially my home base, but I'm traveling almost all the time, basically 360 days a year, so I kind of live out of a suitcase.
And you're traveling 365 days out of the year, more or less, because you're a photographer, correct?
I'm a photographer, yes, yes.
And that work takes you all around the world.
Yes, my photography is all kind of around the built environment, around architecture, cities, and how people live and build. So my commissioned work is usually for architects who fly me around the world. And next to that, I try to document kind of the current state of how people live around the world, from like the informal cities, how people build places themselves, like in a lot of the third world countries in the southern hemisphere, Africa, to like the vernacular, how people used to build places themselves with kind of local materials. So I'm fascinated around these kind of topics.
Are you an architect?
No, I'm a photographer. I've been always photographing, but kind of the last decade moved my work all around architecture. And
So photography, have you always been a photographer? I mean, tell me about your career as a photographer. How did it get started?
Yeah.
At some point it evolves into architecture. But
I got my first camera when I was 12 years old, so it was from my grandma as a small present, and I was immediately hooked to it, and I've been photographing since, basically. I went to art school, studied photography there. It was in the Netherlands. And then for the first 7 years or so after art school, did much more documentary photography, travel stories, stories on places and people. And about 10 years ago, I met Rem Koolhaas, the Dutch architect, Pritzker Prize winner, and started working with him, and that sort of brought me into the whole architecture field.
So renowned architects call you, ask you, send you emails, however they get a hold of you in this day and age, and they request that you come and take pictures of their work. Is that correct? Is that what you're currently doing?
Like a lot of the commissioned work is usually like a new building open somewhere in the world. They asked me to document their new creation there, and especially also what's happening around these places. Like, that's one of my interests, always showing a lot what people do in these places, how these buildings are occupied and how these buildings make part of a city, of a landscape, of the urban scape around it. So that's also a bit how I select my projects. It's not just a building, not just architecture or like a perfect detail, but also much more sort of a story around the building and why a building is in a specific place.
And then, so you get commissioned, you go to a place. How do you go about your work? I mean, how do you, eventually you're going to produce these pictures that are going to be the right pictures, but how do you get there?
It's always a very intuitive way of working. You spend a couple days in a place, and it's just like being there and experiencing the place and see, sort of finding out what's unique to a place, what makes a place, and how people occupy that place. And for me, it's interesting to find out sort of why a building is specifically in this place, in this kind of environment, and not somewhere else, and to visualize that and make that visible to a public, to an audience. Like, these pictures go usually to the magazines, newspapers, architectural press, books, exhibitions, and so. So yeah, you want to give people who aren't in that place an experience of how it is to be there, and how you experience that space. And of course, architecture is very much about experiencing a space, and a three-dimensional space, which as a photographer you have to transform into basically a flat image. So for me, it's important to add something more, just to a photograph of a building, but telling that story of why it's there and what people do there.
Do you have a sense already in your mind what you think the picture, the good pictures are going to be, or is it just a blank canvas when you show up? You've got some information, but yeah. It's really a blank canvas, and you're going to have to see it in all times of day.
I think so. Like, it depends so much also on the place, and it's hard to say, like, this is the recipe which you're going to follow, and that's how you photograph a place. So you try to find sort of what's the unique thing of that place, and especially when you travel so much, like I'm literally in the plane every 2 or 3 days somewhere else in the world, and so you really try to find something unique for that place, why is this building in Japan and not in the US or in Europe, and try to tell that unique story of a place.
Did you bring your camera on this trip?
I always have a camera with me. Nowadays, it's your phone.
You've probably been on such a tight schedule, though. I mean, are you constantly looking out the window and thinking, well, I'd like to come back here and take a picture of that?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah,
you're kind of pre-programmed as a photographer to always look at places. And it's fascinating here to see Alaska and sort of the wide open environment and built environment, which is in a way so minuscule compared to the rest of the environment here. So it gives a total different sense of place.
Built environment, literally meaning what we have built as a society.
People do, and what people build and how they make a home or a shelter for themselves.
So I'm assuming the recognition you've received, obviously you're taking some extraordinary pictures. You're not just taking pictures of places, but your own sense of design that goes into these images. I'm assuming that's why you're being commissioned to travel around the world and do this, is that you capture art in you're capturing the design that the architects are interested in having, but you're also doing it in your own artistic way.
Yeah, and it's not just like the building or these people, but it's also very much capturing a moment in time, what's important for me, whereas a lot of the architectural photography is always so much about giving a kind of complete sterile image of a building, of a corner, of an architectural detail. And I'm not an architect. I know very little about architecture in a way. But it's for me, it's important to tell that other story and really give it a moment in time. And like that's also how I select projects, that it's all capturing the current state of architecture and built environment.
So for people who come tonight, so again, you are here with the Alaska Design Forum, and you're going to be the speaker, the presenter this evening at the Gold Town Theater starting at 6 o'clock. For people who come tonight, give a feel for what are you going to talk about? What are they going to see?
Yeah. No, I was thinking for tonight I will show a bit my other work. Like a lot of people know my commissioned work and architectural work, which is published in all the magazines, newspapers around the world, and you can look it up everywhere online. And so people know that kind of commissioned work a lot. But my interest is also very much in these in the cities and the places around it. And lately I've been doing also quite some projects really on larger cities where architecture plays a very important role, but it's not just the specific buildings, but kind of how architecture grew in these places. And recently I was invited by the Moscow Art Biennale to do a project on Ekaterinburg in Russia, which was kind of the birthplace for Russian constructivism, which you see still sort of everywhere around the city. A kind of similar project which I recently did in Chicago for the Architecture Biennale, really on Chicago. And then I just finished a book on modernism in Africa and Africa continent, which we don't really consider so much in connection with architecture, but it has actually a very rich history of architecture, and it's a project I've been exploring over the last 2.5 years with the the university in Zurich, the ETH, and it's recently culminated in a book which we published. So I'm showing these kind of projects.
And then, what's next? What's your big next project that you've got, or do you have so many of them in a row that it's hard to?
Yeah, there's always kind of a mix of this, the commissioned works, which brings you to places, to cities for a specific moment, like an opening of a building, inauguration of a building, sometimes documenting the construction of a place. And then there's these kind of longer term projects, books, exhibitions, and so what I'm working on at the moment. I'm working on a book with Harvard University on landscape architecture and how atmospheres basically can be almost created through landscape architecture. So looking at a number of very specific places around the world where landscape architecture and climates come very much together. So documenting a kind of very ephemeral thing like a climate and a weather pattern almost in architecture.
So for people listening right now who are intrigued and are curious about your images, where would you direct them? If they wanted to look you up right now and see some pictures, where would they go?
Yeah, like I published quite a number of books which you can look up on Amazon. They're you can buy them there. Exhibitions here and there. The architectural press, which usually publishes things, if you want to be updated, see what's happening sort of around my work. I have a Facebook page where usually all the news items sort of come on. So these are the ways you can keep in touch.
Evelyn, you okay over there? Quietly coughing in the background.
Sorry. I'm allergic to this room.
with the Alaska Design Forum, and we just have a brief moment here, architecture, art, and design, three interesting things that somewhere intersect in every day in our lives. And how does the forum go about selecting presenters?
Well, we're all about exploring ideas around the built environment, and so every year we have a theme. Our theme this year is Future Tense, and every year we try to pick speakers who will represent a variety of disciplines, speakers who are in different phases of their career, perhaps, and come from different parts of the world to make it really diverse. And we've actually been trying to get Ewan to come for several years now, right? We've been in contact for 4 or 5 years at least. So really excited that he has finally been able to make it here. That's kind of how we do it, a broad range.
All right. Ewan, we are running out of time. I could talk for another 5 minutes, but welcome to Juno. Good luck tonight. Thanks for your beautiful art.
Great. Thanks for having me here.
COO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. We also rebroadcast on translators K276AF in the Mendenhall Valley and Auk Bay, K269AO in Lemon and Schweitzer Creeks, K210AM in Gustavus, K220BT in Hoonah, and K210AS in Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait. In Juno, KTOO is on GCI Cable on digital channel 871. We're also online at ktoo.org. Support for national programming on KTOO comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners like you.
Donald Trump passes on the last debate before Iowa Voters Caucus.
Bernie Sanders pays a visit to the White House for a sit-down with President Obama.
How candidates are spending the final days before primary voting season.
Today is Wednesday, January 27th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Audie Cornish.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Also this hour, lawmakers grapple with the nation's heroin and prescription drug abuse problem.
We simply pass out painkillers like candy in America, and we're unwilling to have that conversation.
And at the Sundance Film Festival, internet streaming services drive up the price of indie films.
Amazon and Netflix are going in like gangbusters and saying, we like this movie, we like the sounds of this movie. Sometimes they haven't even seen it yet, and they're buying.
And the Dutch conductor who's set to take over the nation's oldest orchestra, the New York Philharmonic.
Those stories after this news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Speer. Ferguson, Missouri, and the Department of Justice appear close to settling civil rights complaints against the city's police department and municipal. Radio's Rachel Lipman reports a draft of a proposed consent decree was released today.
The agreement must be approved by Ferguson's city council and a federal judge. It would leave the city in charge of its police department and municipal court, but requires a complete overhaul of the municipal code and a thorough review of policing policies and training. It also explicitly outlaws using policing as a tool to generate revenue. The draft comes nearly a year after the DOJ's Civil Rights Division found the city routinely violated the civil rights of its black residents. That report was prompted by the August 2014 shooting death of an unarmed black 18-year-old by a white police officer. In separate statements, the federal government and city officials called the proposed consent decree the best deal for both sides. Approval in February means Ferguson would avoid a lawsuit. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Lipman in St. Louis.
Authorities say the armed group occupying the National Wildlife Preserve in Oregon was given ample opportunity to leave peacefully. Greg Britzing with the FBI's Portland office says authorities took a measured approach to those who took over the refuge in a protest over what they deemed federal intrusion on individual rights. During a traffic stop and arrest last night, one of the men in the group was killed. Seven other protesters were arrested. It was revealed in a criminal complaint the armed group had explosives and night vision goggles. The U.S. Chemical Safety Board is releasing its investigation into the catastrophic fertilizer explosion in the town of West Texas 2 years ago that killed 15 people and injured more than 150 others. As NPR's John Burnett explains, every entity comes in for sharp criticism.
The now bankrupt West Fertilizer Company improperly stored potentially hazardous ammonium nitrate fertilizer and had no safety plans if a fire broke out. The report says that federal and state oversight of work and safety practices inside fertilizer plants fell short. The company's insurance carrier never inspected the facility. The West Volunteer Fire Department, which lost five responders that day, was not trained in how to fight a blaze at the local fertilizer warehouse and didn't know that it might blow up like a bomb. Most chilling, the Chemical Safety Board says that half of the 40 ammonium nitrate storage facilities in Texas sit within a half mile of schools, nursing homes, hospitals, and homes, just like the West Fertilizer Company did. John Burnett, NPR News, Austin.
Michigan officials say water samples in the city of Flint are, quote, trending better, though they say it's too soon to give the okay for residents to resume drinking unfiltered water. Flint Mayor Karen Weaver announced the city has hired a Virginia Tech professor whose initial testing helped bring the problem of high lead levels in city water to light.
Dr. Mark Edwards has been retained by the city of Flint to oversee all water testing done by the state and the federal government.
Weaver says the testing is being funded through private donations. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 222 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from Disney, presenting The Finest Hours, based on the true story of 34 men stranded at sea and the rescue attempt by the U.S. Coast Guard to bring them home. The Finest Hours, starring Chris Pine and Casey Affleck, in theaters everywhere this Friday.
Good afternoon. You're listening to All Things Considered on KTOO. I'm Dominique Johnson with this local news update. Governor Bill Walker says he wants the state and the North Slope's major producers to reach agreement on key contracts and issues related to a major gas project before the end of the current legislative session. If the parties don't reach alignment on those issues, he says we'll have no other choice but to consider other options for commercializing Alaska's gas. The comments came in a letter Walker sent last week to leaders of BP, ConocoPhillips, and ExxonMobil. The three are partners with the state in pursuing a major liquefied natural gas project. Lawmakers are expected to receive an update from the project's partners Wednesday. Governor Bill Walker's administration is proposing a renewed focus on cracking down on waste and fraud in Alaska's Medicaid program. It is part of a broader revamped bill aimed at curbing and containing costs within Medicaid. The bill would set up civil penalties for false claims and allow citizens who bring cases to the Attorney General's attention to receive a portion of the proceeds from a settlement if a case is pursued. State Health Commissioner Valerie Davidson says this would exponentially increase the number of those looking for fraud. The Senate Finance Committee on Wednesday heard the bill and another Medicaid reform bill from Senator Pete Kelly, which also includes fraud prevention measures. Both were referred to a special subcommittee for review and recommendations for Senate Finance to consider. And tonight's forecast calls for rain showers, lows around 40 degrees, Southeast winds around 10 to 20 miles per hour. For tomorrow, rain showers, highs around 43. Southeast winds around 10 to 20 miles per hour. You're listening to All Things Considered on KTOO. We're also online at ktoo.org.
The Great Alaska Bluegrass Band and the Rob Cohen Jazz Trio are just a few of the additions to this year's KTOO and Taku Fisheries Seafood Festival. That's right, we've added live music, additional restaurants, and moved the seafood sampling extravaganza to Centennial Hall to accommodate...